Friday, December 4th, 2009, a lecture by Bradley Topeski to the Carl Jung Society of Seattle. Hieronymus Bosch, Garden of Earthly Delights. Bradley Topeski, Ph.D., received his diploma in analytical psychology from the C.G. Jung Institute for Analytical Psychology in Zurich, Switzerland, 1982, and an American Ph.D. in depth psychology from the Union Institute of Cincinnati in 1987. Prior to this calling, he earned a Bachelor of Fine Arts from the University of Iowa and a Master of Fine Arts degree in printmaking from the University of Massachusetts, where he also studied art history. He has been a Jungian analyst and clinical psychologist in private practice for over 25 years in Minnesota, New Mexico, and California, serving also as an individual and group psychotherapist with the program in human sexuality at the University of Minnesota Medical School in Minneapolis, the Parent Assistance Center in Santa Fe, Child Abuse Listening and Meditation, CALM, in Santa Barbara, and the Violence Intervention Program and Inner City Domestic Violence Program in East Los Angeles. Bradley is the author of Rape and Ritual, A Psychological Study, Inner City, 1982, and Sexuality and the Religious Imagination, Spring 2008, and a contributor to The Allure of Gnosticism, The Gnostic Experience in Jungian Psychology and Contemporary Culture, published by Open Court in 1995, and The Sacred Heritage, The Influence of Shamanism on Analytical Psychology, Routledge Press, 1997. His teaching is known for its thorough topical research, informal style, and the many artistic images he employs. Topeski is also a traveling lecturer and teacher who welcomes invitation from interested groups and organizations. Now, tonight's talk also featured the display of many paintings by Hieronymus Bosch and others, which are not available on this audio. But these are available, they are not copyrighted, and they're available on the internet. Here's the description for the lecture. The enchanted painting of Hieronymus Bosch, 1453 to 1516, represents an enigmatic interpretive puzzle of Northern Renaissance art, a heretical response to the patriarchal religious establishment of the late medieval period, and an archetypal cartwheel across the sensual skin of the Great Mother. Employing detailed slides of this entire triptych, Dr. Topeski will explore Bosch's religious milieu, his florid imagery, and his portrayal of the extremes of the senses in an earthly paradise and the Low Country's most famous hell, depth psychological reflections on anima and eros, the claims of Mother Earth, and the self, as both body image and inner world image will complement Bosch's remarkable work and preview major themes of our guest's recently published book, Sexuality and the Religious Imagination.
Okay, welcome. Thank you for coming. Again, my name is Tom Wilkinson. I'm on the program committee. And tonight we're going to have Hieronymus Bosch explained, finally, after, 500 years? I don't want to put the pressure on you, Bradley. Hieronymus Bosch explained tonight. Bradley is a Jungian analyst and a teacher and a writer, and this is his latest book. I'm almost finished with it. It's a very, very good read. A lot of history, and it's well written. The title of it is Sexuality and the Religious Imagination. You know, you could probably do a better job of introducing the lecture tonight. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right. Let's welcome Bradley Topeski. Okay.
All right. Well, it's a pleasure to be here in Seattle. I have driven through once on my way to Vancouver, B.C. Another time was here for a weekend because it's the only time a son of mine who was in medical school in Connecticut could be out here for a seminar and have a weekend to go explore the Olympic Peninsula. So that's exciting and a great honor for me to come to your city and to speak for you tonight. I feel a bit like a bee who's gathered too much more honey and pollen and maybe ecological pressure this week and come quite laden because my amazing things have kind of gone on my practice lately. It's been a challenging week nationally for us, for you locally with things in Wood, in the suburb where you lost your policeman, etc. And there's so many associations with traveling and coming up here that anyhow, I'm keyed up to speak with you tonight in just the right way. I wanted to start by giving you a brief quote that comes from 1517 from the secretary of an Italian cardinal who was touring the Low Countries. A note by the secretary Antonio de Bietas. I don't care who the cardinal was. He said, and it's a noting of seeing a Bosch painting in a collection in Brussels, and it goes like this. "And then there are some panels on which bizarre things have been painted. Here, seas, skies, woods, meadows, and many other things are represented, such as those figures that emerge from a shell or from others that defecate, cranes, men and women, white and blacks in different activities and poses, birds, animals of all kinds, executed very naturally, things that are so delightful and fantastic that it is impossible to describe them to those who have not seen them." And with that, if you turn on the first slide. And I regret turn out the lights with this. We'll have to do it this way. I appreciate the resourcefulness of having this appear with a bit ago so we can split the difference between who gets the light on them. Okay. An exploration of Bosch is necessarily both an exploration of a unique creative genius of Western art, his artistic, cultural, and religious milieu, and a colorful exploration of the archetypal world. The old adage, "the only universal is the local," is germane here. For while we as individuals are generally convinced about the uniqueness of our lives and experiences, our biographies, personalities, and capacity for reflective consciousness, all those are ultimately shaped by ancient and highly transpersonal, or archetypal, if you will, categories of behavior and imagination. Now, tonight, I'm not going to talk about therapy, and this is definitely not a clinical lecture, but rather a reflection on cultural history and the play of the archetypes in an important cultural and artistic point in our European history. Now, in proceeding, I will show you lots of detailed slides of Bosch's altar and some other wonderful works of art from his milieu. I'll share some personal reflections, which I hope will be sufficient to introduce myself and to satisfy my assumption of your curiosity about how your speaker came to see things in the particular way that I do. This is the central panel of the altar we'll be considering. Hieronymus Bosch's famous Garden of Earthly Delights is a large altarpiece, approximately 7 by 12 feet overall, with three panels executed by the artist between 1505 and 1510. It hangs today in the Museo del Prado, in the Prado Museum in Madrid. I was captivated upon seeing a reproduction of the work for the first time as a 19-year-old art student and have remained fascinated and influenced by it in my own studio work, a bit of which I'll include way at the end, though I did have to wait for nearly 35 years to finally see the original. Arlene and I went there, I think it was about 5 years ago, in conjunction with a Jungian conference in Barcelona. Now, this presentation, this is the first example, will employ two sets of slides of the work. One that retains its old smoky patina and antique look, the one I knew as a kid, and the second purchased in Madrid after the work was restored. This is definitely the older one prior to its restoration. Okay. And you will see then the altarpiece. It's a triptych altarpiece in three panels, And you'll see all three of those at least twice, plus the details. And we went with the wall instead of the smaller screen to push those details forward. Oh, okay, pardon me. Okay. Now, seeing the original, we'll get to that later, I was startled at its light tone and pastel colors in a way similar to many people's response to Michelangelo's frescoes in the Sistine Chapel after its controversial restoration. I couldn't help but smile about that reference to Michelangelo in light of the drawing show of the Sistine Chapel by Michelangelo, though, that we'll be hoping to see while we're in town. In any case, always provocative and now 500 years old, Bosch's altar continues to be an enigmatic puzzle in Northern Renaissance art, lending itself to varied interpretations even as art historians continue to make new discoveries that demand a periodic update in one's perspective of the altar. And this paper, of necessity, is a case in point. My necessity in thoroughly recasting this paper, which I have given before in Minneapolis and other places, St. Louis, has to do with the persuasive and very seductive power of an influential scholar. It has to do also with the dependency of depth psychologists generally upon current scholarship and the question of one's own subjective assumptions in entering into a complicated debate. Now, the original version of this talk was accordingly strongly influenced by a rather extravagant German art historian named Wilhelm Freyinger, whose popular tome, Big Chunk, was in all the art store, you know, any museum shop around the world had that big book on Bosch for quite a number of years in the 60s. And he held that Hieronymus Bosch, or he made the case, that Hieronymus Bosch painted that altar commissioned by a heretical sect of Dutch Adamites, or millennialists. That is, free-thinking spiritualists who anticipated the advent of the 1,000-year earthly reign by God's special elect, cited in the biblical book of Revelation as a prelude to the last judgment. Okay. I'll try to do my best to focus here. Okay, this is, of course, the most famous hell seen in the whole of Northern Renaissance art. Okay. Now, Freyinger even refers to Bosch's work as the Millennium Altar. And, of course, it was a particularly provocative for me with a Jungian training and experience that he also saw or posited that the work was filled with subtle alchemical symbolism. That's enough to tweak anyone's interest who's ever read Psychology and Alchemy. Now, my own Dutch background, the medieval research that went into my book, Sexuality and the Religious Imagination, a Jungian archetypal purview, and incidentally Freyinger, quotes Jung quite liberally, all suggest why Freyinger was so persuasive to me. But here I need hurriedly to acknowledge my debt in revisioning this talk to a wonderful friend of mine named Professor Craig Harbison, now emeritus, who was my professor of Northern Renaissance at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, and who shared his recent research on Bosch and convincingly counters Franger's provocative proposition that the Garden of Earthly Delight was at least commissioned by heretics of the sort described. Mm-hmm. Now, that does not say that there were not such heretics or that he was not fully aware of them, and we'll find out reasons for that as we look later at the cleaner, brighter version of this famous hell panel. There's a few details that give that are strong, that point in that direction. Okay. All right. Pardon me here. Okay. My initial chagrin at this discovery quickly turned into amazement that the same work of art could be seen so differently. I had to get beyond an either or look. Indeed, my whole work, in lecture tonight, and my whole book is about getting beyond either or. And although I would love to, I'm not sure, there's no one who can explain Bosch he has to be left open. That's one of the main points. The word explain means to take all the wrinkles out. And we really, we owe Bosch more than that. Okay. And we owe our imagination, and the imagination that gets going in us by experiencing his work, more than that. Because they're living images, at least what gets stirred in us. What's really remarkable to me, I realized that years ago I studied the archetype of sacrifice a lot. And for several months and months and months. And I learned a lot about it, but it still stayed a mystery. And I can look at Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights with the same fascination and delight that I first looked upon it with all those years ago. It really stays remarkably alive. And so I'm hoping that you'll take similarly perseverating and engaged appreciation of it. Now, what remains is the central way in which Bosch's remarkable personality, aside from the debates about him, his remarkable personality, creative psychic consciousness, that great reconciler of opposites, and multifaceted imagery in both embraces and transcends the conflict described. Just as Bosch can neither be called a simple moralist nor a mere painter of fantasy. Mm-hmm. Now, proceeding, I'll characterize the alternate religious currents, including a couple examples of their quasi-sacramental sexual behaviors in the centuries preceding Bosch, but as I said, with which he was clearly familiar. This material is also intimately related to themes we'll be exploring in the workshop tomorrow, and it was certainly intimately familiar to Bosch and his circle. Now, as I've said, my approach is a depth psychological, an archetypal, but also, I think, a profoundly ecological one. I think we will see in Bosch, you will see in Bosch's work, and I'll point that along the way, the remarkable sensitivity to nature that he had. And we'll say a little bit more about a dualistic perspective or a split kind of perspective, part of that either or a holistic aesthetic and mythological perspective on Bosch, rather than getting him nailed down. Okay. Now, the provocative old word heresy remains pertinent here. It is derived from the Latin word heresis, meaning an act of taking or a choice. Its connotations are individual. Indeed, much of what I'll have to say about Bosch as altar this evening and about sexuality in the Religious Imagination Seminar represents a precise counterpoint to a moralized patriarchal Christianity. I emphasize patriarchal there and its values. This may sound only radical, but only until it is clearly understood that and I have a whole chapter on this in my new book, that the fundamental tenet, and this is a very important starting point, of the patriarchal sexual morality drawn from the ancient Middle East, elaborated by the Jews, the Greeks, the Romans, St. Paul, and church fathers like St. Augustine and Jerome, consists in the proposition that every form of sexual behavior not specifically devoted procreation and the propagation of the species is essentially unacceptable. Okay? From the simplest pleasure taken in sex to masturbation to erotic fantasy to pre or extramarital relations, on and on to whatever extreme. And this is no less significant whether we're talking about heretical sex and the sexuality of the kind that Freyinger emphasized, or the sophisticated sexual attitudes and amusements of the Burgundian court, which ruled Holland in Bosch's day and were aligned with the Roman Catholic Church. There's still, of course, given the history of indulgences and the purchase of them in Catholic history, a courtly sphere and its allegiance to the Catholic Church leaves plenty of room for all kinds of sexuality of every sort. And because, of course, it's patriarchally oriented, or as Cornel West, a writer I like, talks about, Constantinian, imperial, patriarchal Christianity prevails there. Okay. Now, clearly, this central tenet of patriarchal sexual morality runs roughshod over any significance, which we know, of course, from Freud, which sexuality might have in the development of personality. And, of course, the proposition of personality is a bit suspicious. The further you go back in history, of course, on a tribal level, but under a patriarchal aegis, you are part of the group, the empire, the land, the kingdom. Personality was reserved for very special individuals. Okay. Now, furthermore, we must bear in mind and there is a counterpoint to this central patriarch tenet, pardon me for stuttering here, I'm finding my place. It's the proposition that the alternate proposition that procreation is a mere footnote to sexuality, and that to curse sexuality and the body and its energies and behaviors is in itself a serious transgression. This is akin to the notion that marriage is merely for the propagation of the species. Somewhere Jung talks about the breeding stock attitude toward marriage, or just the propagation of the species attitude marriage. And in one of his writings says, where she is nothing but ma, and he is nothing but dad, and they even call each other that. Okay. And also, call to mind Adolf Guggenbull's point in his book on marriage, dead or alive, that marriage, a real individuation marriage, is what is the point of being married. How two persons reflect and mirror and battle and fall back in love and go round and round through that, because it prompts and creates and sustains a whole ongoing differentiation of the masculine elements in one personality and feminine. Okay, and partly tomorrow we'll talk a lot about the innate gender equation that each of us have within us, which may or not have something to do with preference, choice, or whatever, but is definitely, we could think of it in Jungian terms of the old anima and animus, active, or the masculine and feminine, active in the differentiating of our personalities. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, it's crucial to bear in mind here also, going further, is that particularly in Paul and Augustine, and you find it well in the medieval period, and as well as in contemporary fundamentalist, yes, I'll go ahead and say it, bigotry, all sexual variations were also taken as an indication, and still in the Middle Ages, and still are, of alternate sexual inclinations, which is a complicated topic, which is why my book took the shape it did, and which we'll discuss more tomorrow, because they definitely are. Okay. Now, this presents any human being, indeed the whole population, proposition of individuation, with a torturous dilemma. It demands the systematic elimination of sensation. I have to clarify here, this particular rejection of alternate sexuality, etc. What it also entails, to clarify, is that it presents us with a torturous dilemma, because in that it demands the systematic elimination of sensation, passion, femininity, bisexuality, the reality and of the corporeal body. You know, Jung once made the remark, it's a terrible discovery finding authentic religious meaning in the body is a very disturbing discovery for many good Christians. That was said years ago. But it's places where it still holds true today. But also, it comes down on nature, matter, everything non-rational and even one's own individual imagining. Okay? From a depth psychological perspective, this leaves virtually nothing of which the soul could possibly be imagined to consist. For soul is always related to the body and to created things, and it consists of a stream of energy and protein images within us that's always a part also as psychosoma of an entire organism. Okay. These are all validated, however, and accepted as natural and religious parts of things in religious systems where there's a substantial feminine element. Or, for instance, in religions that are oriented toward the great goddesses of the past, whether that's the Eleusinian mysteries or those the Canaanite religions, et cetera, the Aphrodite cult. Okay. Okay. Now, there's a philosopher I'd like to quote who picks up on this. Everything that's damned, negated, rendered suspicious, or whatever, that I've just mentioned, but says it with such pique and intensity that it's still shocking to many ears today, but it comes from 1872. I'm referring to the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who was the son of a Lutheran minister, and offers this critique in his book, in his writing called The Birth of Tragedy, where he's really steeped in the religions and spirit of antiquity and our whole pagan, as well as our own Judeo-Christian religious trajectory. And this is what he says about Christianity, or the Christianity from his perspective. I'll take my time with it. Christianity was, from the start, essentially and thoroughly disgust and weariness with life, which only dressed itself up, only hid itself in, only decorated itself with the belief in an other or better life. The hatred of the world, the curse against the emotions, the fear of beauty and sensuality, a world beyond created, so that the world on this side might be more easily slandered. At bottom, a longing for nothingness, for extinction, for rest, until the Sabbath of all Sabbaths. All that, as well as the absolute, and this is very important here, the absolute desire of Christianity to value only moral worth, has always seemed to me the most dangerous, the most eerie form of all possible manifestations of a will to destruction. At least a sign of the deepest illness, weariness, bad temper, exhaustion, and impoverishment in living. End of quote. Okay. I remember once seeing a bumper sticker on the back of a great big, Mercedes SUV or something, that said, in case of the rapture, the vehicle's yours. That's a freeway version of that same snotty, irresponsibly apocalyptic, self-centered, earth-negating thumbing at the created world. Mm-hmm. And it's insidious. And it's all around. Okay. Now Nietzsche goes on to speak of an aesthetic rather than a moral evaluation of life. And of course, Nietzsche scared the hell out of people years ago with his provocative statement that God was dead. God is dead. There's a bit of bitterness in the man for having been a Lutheran minister's son, if you hadn't noticed. Okay. But also, Nietzsche's speaking of being 1,000 years beyond good and evil. Now, we're going to get to some remarks from some of the heretics we'll take a look at. And they had that will pick up on that, 1,000 years beyond good and evil, and it's important here. No wonder that is startling, because that is a stepping out of let's see, normative morals and normative social things is always, you know, threatening from the establishment, from the patriarchy's point of view. And that's one of the reasons why deep analytic work takes place in such an internal or, you know, incubation kind of way, behind closed doors. And of course, when you go into psyche, you're experimenting with a lot of moral relativism all along. Why? Because you take, like Jung makes a statement, it's very Swiss in a way, any true moral decision starts where the penal code leaves off. Okay? This goes on all the time. When you go down into the reality of your own living psychic life, things get as filled with contrasts and as intense in the play of wondrous beauty and moments of terror as we will see in this altar. Okay. So what Jung was very, very staunch on that. He felt a tremendous responsibility after his so-called time of confrontation with the unconscious about bringing back to the collective what he had learned from his delvings, and a fierce moral sense of moral responsibility, but regarding the exercise of one's own innate moral function. And the rules don't help you when you're really in that Faustian fix. Okay. Now, anyhow, this is also, with stronger, milder language, an affirmation of our existence on this earth, and we are the generation who will take measures to take care of it, and ultimately, the success of our species is going to be decided in our lifetimes. So this is major things to come to terms with. But about that aesthetic rather than a moralistic perspective, that's woven in here. Okay? Let's take a step out of the moralistic box into the queen of the ascetic, Aphrodite Venus. Okay? The word aesthetic is wonderful. I heard Jim Hillman talk about this. It's an onomatopoetic word. It comes from that when you experience beauty that just stops you. You know? And the aesthetic thing is right there in the big promise of even Catholicism, that the saved person will experience the visio beatifica, a stunning, joyous, beyond moral, immediate experience of the Virgin Rose, of the mystery of the spiritual feminine, who in Catholic mysticism and Christian mysticism merges with Christ, the old in Gnosticism, Christ and Syzygy, or Christ and Sophia, forming a Syzygy together, a dynamic pair. Okay. So also in antiquity, the history of the word, the aesthetic, refers to the entire sensual world, the whole sensual experience of being here. Okay. Now, here, those reflections on anima and eros, and on the claims of the Earth Mother, not stated, I don't think, in the publicity, but also the entire Dionysian side of life, the god Dionysus, who is, all of these are replete in the altar that we're going to continue to explore much more in detail. So this is an extended introduction. Okay? But anyhow, this particular altar, the central panel, we'll see clearer picture of it, is to me the most elaborate Dutch anima fantasy I've ever seen. All those pretty, lean, fair-skinned, blonde Dutch girls, such as caught my eye, as for narcissistic reasons, as a college kid, etc., etc. Okay. Well, I would just add one additional thing before we go to the opening of the altarpiece, and that is a statement that's included in my book by a wonderful, if eccentric, French writer named Alain Danielieu. His book on actually on Shiva and Dionysus, where he says, speaks of nature, humankind, religion, and the question of ecology in the fullest sense, and comes to the statement where a religion which does not respect the indissoluble oneness of creation and which is not fundamentally ecological is nothing but a fraud. Jung addresses this directly when he says, the truth, life is the touchstone for the truth of the spirit. Spirit that takes off only on its own way and loses touch with life is a false spirit, but we too are responsible for the individual can decide whether to surrender themselves to that or not. Okay. Now, this lovely and mysterious thing is like a big eye in a way. Jung somewhere talks about that we all have a world imago in us that's almost like a big eye. We see the world, and that's formed. There's a synergy between coming into the world and having our psyche, the archetypal endowment in us, come alive to the world and start having an experience of it. Okay. Now, up in the corner there, you can see there's Yahweh on high, the Jewish and Christian high God or Father God, and this beautiful sphere of the forming world. It's a difficult to make just in a monochrome like this, a grisaille. So, like, this would be the first kind of way a painting would be done before colors are laid over it with alternating layers of egg tempera and oil. But anyhow, the inscriptions say, and it's from Psalm 33:9, "For he spoke and it was done. He commanded and it stood fast." And while scripturally based, it's a rather stock phrasing. Likewise, another verse from Psalms has been cited in relation to this altar, which goes, it's Psalm 148:9 on. "Mountains and all hills, fruit trees and all cedars, wild animals and all cattle, creeping things and flying birds, kings of the earth and all peoples, princes of all rulers of the earth, young men and women alike, old and young together." Okay. Now, I've showed you this picture of Aphrodite, Venus, and I wanted to share with you because I'm, of course, very concerned. If you're going to talk what I've said so far about embracing the world, that's where the feminine and the goddesses who have perseverated into Christianity. I mean, Joseph Campbell says you could not find a more beautiful celebration of the Holy Mother, the great goddess, than in the Chartres Cathedral. That's interesting because Chartres Cathedral was devoted to Sophia. It was St. Bernard, who was one of the great devotees of Sophia, was responsible in its building. Hildegard of Bingen was right there at the same time, one of the most beautiful visionaries Catholicism has ever brought us. Okay, but anyhow, this I just wanted to share with this is a picture of Sophia from a manuscript. And besides the creation story, the two narratives that we know in Genesis, there's another one you should check out, Proverbs 8. Another one there where suddenly God, the Father, has a beautiful handmaiden. And she describes herself like this. "The Lord created me at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts of long ago. Ages ago I was set up, at the first, before the beginnings of the earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there was no spring abounding with water. Before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills, I was brought forth. When he had not yet made earth or fields or the world's first bits of soil. When he established the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep. When he made firm the skies above. When he established the fountains of the deep and assigned to the sea its limit. When he marked out the foundations," verse, "I was beside him. I was a master worker, and I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him always, rejoicing in his inhabited world." And this is always emotional for me. "And delighting in the human race." This is why Mary is always being the intermediary in Catholicism, and it overlaps on a cosmic level with the anima as the personification of holism, the ligamentum between the opposites, and an essential part of all of depth psychology. Okay, that's from Proverbs 8. In passing here, I wanted to think not just of this as scripture, I'm inevitably here. I'm here as a layperson. I don't have to be theoretical. I'm a devotee of Sophia. She, aside from Kali and Mercury and Hermes, she's the archetype, or I would say the divine personality, who has shown up and does show up. Just listen to Hildegard of Bingen's music. I'll use her as my foil here before I get embarrassed. But we must think of these things as things, and Bosch is going to be our vivid example of the whole jumble of this, is that we're talking about things that occur. We're talking about religious experiences. We're talking about what the psyche really unfolds. And that's why I choose this picture, because it's the feminine form showing up in an aura of light. And interestingly enough, and we're going to be, I mentioned gender equation. We'll look at this tomorrow. My book's filled with it. Here, this is an alchemical picture. Yes, it's a Sophianic figure of light showing up, but it's also called Anima Mercurii. And we'll talk there. There's that androgyny right in the works there. And I wanted to interject with this and to show due respect for the beauty of the human form, whether beautiful child, intact adult, cripple, or old person. Just the aesthetic. Aesthetics does not exclude the tragic, the ugly, the decaying. Okay? But this is a beautiful quote. I've always loved it from Erich Neumann, one of the great Jungians and one of the real devotees of the Great Mother in Jungian tradition. He says this: the great goddess as a whole is a symbol of creative life, and the parts of her body are not physical organs, but numinous symbolic centers of whole spheres of life. For this reason, the self-representation of the great goddess, her display of breasts, belly, or entire naked body, is a form of divine epiphany. Okay? Okay. Okay. This is just lovely beyond all measure, isn't it? Zurbaran, it's a Spanish painter, one of the best. I'm right up there with Velázquez and El Greco. Okay? The reason that I chose this is because there's a Mary and Sophia are really akin. There's one of the wonderful books I've ever read. It's called Mario Sophia, and it's a wonderful study by Schlipfinger, German, and he's in my bibliography. But this is also beautiful. You notice her halo. You notice the lights coming through. Tomorrow I'm going to talk a lot about the scintillae, the little bits of light that Jung talks about as floating in the psyche, always potential to constellate, which means a coming together of stars, that they can form an image and come across into consciousness. And so this is like the veil here. Okay? And so, again, to embed this in Earth and in ecology and our lives, our psychosomas as living, unified things with our planet, with our solar system, and on out from there, let me read you this beautiful thing from an apocryphal gospel. Goes back to the wisdom tradition of Judaism, called the Wisdom of Solomon. And then I'll give you a personal introduction, which will, I think, be a nice step away for a moment. Okay. This is from the Wisdom of Solomon. May God grant, it's a bit of a prayer too. May God grant me to speak with judgment and have thoughts worthy of what I have received. For he is the guide even of wisdom, the corrector of the wise. For both we and our world are in his hand. And are all understanding and skill in crafts. For it is he who gave me unerring knowledge of what exists, to know the structure of the world and the activity of the elements, the beginning and end and middle of times, the alternation of the solstices and the changes of the seasons, the cycles of the year and the constellation of stars, the nature of animals and the temper of wild animals, the powers of spirits and the thoughts of human beings, the varieties of plants and virtues of roots. I learned both what is secret and what is manifest, for wisdom, the fashioner of all things, taught me. That's one thing about the most practical thing with regards to looking at Bosch is that in talking about the anima, the great mother, etc., and her Dionysus, we're talking about things seen in Bosch and things unseen but absolutely there. It's not as I'll say as we proceed. Okay. Now, Hieronymus Bosch is real Dutch soul stuff. We grew up with Rembrandt, Hals, Jan Steen, etc. But Bosch is, and Peter Bruegel, but Bosch is real soul stuff for Dutch history. Okay. Now I include this slide. It's by Peter Bruegel, actually. But I would happen to be off in California, far from my origins, in Santa Barbara at one point, and I was getting ready to teach a class, and I was off in the stacks of the University of UCSB's Art History Library. And I happened to pull down a book of Bruegel and open this up and to this picture. Remember the scintilla idea? Okay, think of this snowflakes in that way. And remember the symmetry, the circularity, the mandalic and of the quality of snowflakes and how they really are all different. We'll come back to that tomorrow and it weaves in here. But just opening this in that sense of, I really got an ethnic hit. Dutchmen, I don't get them that often, but I really got an ethnic hit and I just welled up with tears standing there in the library and I thought, whoa, I've gone way out west from where I came from. But it's such a beautiful thing, just like life on an afternoon of market, on a morning of Saturday morning market in an old Dutch city. Okay. Now, growing up in small town Northwest Ohio, I took for granted a few things that made my college art history classes at Iowa and at the University of Massachusetts feel pretty familiar and congenial. My best friend as a kid was named Mark Vermeer, the son of some 40 families named Vermeer, in Sioux Center, Iowa, where I came from, in the telephone book. You can just look. Okay, the whole back row of our men's choir at church were all Vermeers. And despite the name Sioux, S-I-O-U-X, there wasn't a Native American in sight, or any Jews or Catholics, Latinos, Asians, or any of the other people who make a place like L.A., and I know Seattle, the interesting place that it is in human terms. But we did know a farmer named Van Roysdael, and we had a family friend named Art Van Eyck. There were Steens, Van Dungas, Jordans, and a college professor named Toborsch. Those are all artist names in history of Dutch art, too. And a minister that was at least named Rembrandt, if not Rembrandt. And we got our clothes at Bosch's clothing store in Main Street. And we were all Protestants and Calvinists, no less. That gives you some of the right questions. And very few satisfying answers. And I wanted to just give you one little vignette from that time. Of course, I was late in given my heretical inclinations. I was late in a preoccupation with the Vietnam War at the time. I was cynical, but I had to go see the minister of confirmation class. He was this big, overgrown, noisy guy. He compared himself to St. Peter and stuff. I was suspicious of him the first time I ever laid eyes on him. And he said, well, Brad, he said, I just wanted to talk to you a little bit. You know, one point we should bring up is, do you ever have any trouble with girls? And I said, I don't know. I have girlfriends once in a while, go out and date. What is it that you mean? Well, do you ever get to a point where you feel like you can't hold yourself back? And I said, no, of course. I was like 17. Are you kidding? But anyhow, and I went home, and my mother, who was a farm girl, was just indignant by this. And she said, well, you know, if this ever comes up again, you should say, well, Reverend Bork, tell me, when you're out doing house visitation in the widows' homes, do you ever have any trouble with girls or have any difficulty holding yourself back? He later left town after a little too much hands-on with, banally enough, the church organist, but also simultaneously, which my father thought was the worst blunder, with the head of the local nursing staff at the community hospital. Anyhow, my milieu is from which I emerged is also nicely captured by that old George C. Scott movie, Hardcore, if you ever happened to see it. Okay. I'm going to do something here a moment just to turn, just to ask, is there any questions just at this moment, brief or any clarification? that would you like, that you have just that you've been sitting with and you should tend to? Yes?
I wasn't here at the start, so maybe you said, how many paintings of his are known at the moment?
I have no idea.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. All right, we're going to proceed here. Let's see what... Yeah, good. Okay. Now, Bosch was the son and student of a painter originally from Aachen, a nearby city of mixed Dutch and German heritage west of the Rhine. Okay. And he, his father taught him, and an interesting thing about him was that, as I'm going to try to condense here a little bit as we go, Bosch spent his entire life in a commercial city called Hertogenbosch in the south of Holland, and was there active about 500 years ago. Okay. Interestingly enough, Bosch was about 30 years when he married a very wealthy woman who was his mother's age, 25 years older than he. Thus, he entered into the ranks of one of the wealthiest families in his town. And there's lots of numerous documents from that time in the city records showing how Bosch managed his wife's extensive real estate holdings, and from then on did not need to paint for a living. Okay, and this is one we'll get on to looking at the work very quickly. But the fact that he did not need to paint for a living was a big deal. And the art historian I mentioned, my old teacher Craig Harbison, has this quote that I'll share. Perhaps this one small fact can give us a handle with which to grasp this enigmatic artist's work? Question mark. Steeped in a long family tradition of art making, undoubtedly well acquainted with 15th century artistic developments in both northern and southern parts of Holland, Bosch still emerges as one of the most original and creative artists in the history of Western European painting. In part, this is due to the fact that he is an independent and painter, very conscious of himself and his unique personality, and hence the large Hieronymus Bosch signatures that he and his shop used on several of his works. However much admired by the nobility and ecclesiastical authorities into whose circle he stepped, he was beholden to none of them. Like the vainglorious Burgundy nobility, Bosch seized on the notion of good fame. His independent wealth allows him to pursue his own complex artistic tradition. Okay. Now, this gives you a sense of how he painted in those nice glazing layers. It's a very difficult technique to protect or to develop, but it was common through his whole period and 100 years earlier, going back to Jan van Eyck. Let me focus this a little bit. Alternating an oil, you'd rub it down with oil, paint onto with color, tone, and white tempera, pull out so you could keep building up translucent layers and then pull out the details on every successive layer. Some of those paintings will have just repeated layer upon layer, and that gives them their luminosity so much. I have a painter friend in Massachusetts who's developed that very, very nicely in Boston. Okay. All right. Now, his historical period. As I said, Bosch was at the peak of his power 500 years ago. Now, I want to mention five other artists, and some familiar, and representatives' work just to place Bosch historically. The first two provide kind of brackets and are both very much important, just before Bosch's generation and then following. This is the famous Ghent altarpiece by Jan van Eyck, who was far and away the greatest painter the generation before, Bosch took his turn, followed then in the next generation by Peter Bruegel, who I showed you one picture of, and we'll show you one more in a moment. This is just to give you a bracket and a sort of formal a sense of the formal ways of painting at the time. The one thing this is also supposedly was painted to show the dominion and great Pax Burgundia, the peace and wonderfulness of the Burgundian Empire or region in the generation right before Bosch. This painting down here, its design, the Adoration of the Lamb from the Ghent altarpiece, this thing's huge. It must be like 18, 20 feet wide, 16, 17 feet tall. It's I'm in a big church in Ghent. It's unbelievable. Maybe some of you have seen it. But this is a very important composition that we will see in Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights when we return to that center panel. Okay. Now, this is the first painting I ever remember making a real impression on me. It was in one of those New York Graphic Society folios that they had back in the early 60s that would kind of come apart too easily. The bindings weren't very good. But I can remember it was very provocative when I'm just a wide-eyed little kid and thinking, oh, you know, life is great, like straight lines into the future. To run into this picture where death was so starkly portrayed with encroaching armies here, skull heads like we'd seen in a modern sci-fi movie, and then the overt cruelty to which we're all so painfully accustomed. Demonstrated here where death with his sword is killing a guy and many other facets of that whole thing. I mean, Bruegel most certainly knew of Bosch's hell scene. Okay. Now this gets a little closer, and I'm going to do this with, I'll give you a chance to look at them, of course, to get our eyes working, our retinas warmed up. Perhaps some of you have been to the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. This is one of the, this has been there for many, many years. It's called The Tree of Jesse by an artist from Harlem named Gürten tot St. Jans. That means he was at the house of St. John's. Gürten, he's always called. Good Dutch name. And anyhow, you can see the individualized characters, the different kinds of dress that they had, regional dress, and just a kind of type of figure, and a kind of flatness, too, that was influential on Hieronymus Bosch. These figure types are especially nice. Now, the next one gives a little bit of a sense of the kind of landscape was becoming important then, and that's around leading up to 1500, the years before that. Gürten was significant as a landscape painter, and of course that shows a new sentience for the human beings in a given world. Okay. And this gives you some sense of the background of it. The theme is the burning of the bones of St. John the Baptist. But the point I'm showing with you is that this is some way is representative of the kind of landscape that you'll see go wild with Bosch. But this was current in the time, and he did know Gürten tot St. Jans of his work. It was regional. It was a northern influence coming down to Het Hollandsbosch, which is more in the south of Holland. Okay. Now, this one is interesting, too, and this is exemplary, first of all, manuscripts, illuminated manuscripts generally, and the kind of grotesques and scroll works and this and that we see here. I couldn't help but think of the release of Myung's Red Book, which is a very self-conscious, antiquarian look, just because he wanted to frame himself, I think, just because he felt so profoundly and deeply a piece of history. You know? But anyhow, this is it's from a book called A Book of Hours. There are lots of things called Book of Hours. This one is by the master of Catherine of Cleve from Utrecht, also in north central Holland. Harbison mentions, for instance, that visions of hell that rival those soon to be created by Hieronymus Bosch. Other borders in this Book of Hours manuscript come alive with a variety of contemporary paraphernalia cleverly tied to saints in the main scene, bird cages, coins, pretzels, banners, large feathers, peas in pods, on and on. I sometimes think Hieronymus Bosch must have lay in bed just with his imagination, just tumbling along. Like Jung, I'm sure he would feel a great affinity with what Jung went through in his confrontation with the unconscious. You just can't have imagery like this happen in your artistic soul without it really, challenging the mythical ego integrity. Okay, But it's somebody also commented, it's kind of like this, the decorations and scroll work, they kind of crawl out of the manuscripts onto Bosch's canvases and go a bit wild. Now, this is also, and since we're talking about sexuality this weekend, this is interesting. It was shown, I saw this in Time magazine, which is the same illustration. And if you look up at this close, it has an extraordinary gynecological feel to it. Like labia pulled open, like a birth canal, like a vaginal canal. And with the teeth and demonic stuff, which is the same old Christian and medieval demonization of all that, but part of that classic thing of the vagina dentata motif. You know, the fear of that Freud, you know, Freudians spoke of that. It's an old, old idea. The fear of the feminine organ, or of women generally. Okay? Lots of hell mouths in old paintings have kind of that hinterland. And the unconscious comes through the same door that we did. Okay. This is another, just an influence right before. It's one of the most famous woodcarver of the day, a guy named Adrian van Wessel, The Meeting of the Magi. Okay? So just give that a moment. Let's see. They're all on horseback. Here. It's hard to see. Here and on that side. Okay. Let me see what's in there. Okay. This is another thing from the altar. I'm going to move ahead a little bit. I think I'm not exactly sure when we began as far as on the clock. So I'm just going to let this set here for just a moment for you to have get us right back to thinking about Bosch after these himself and our altar. I'll say a few things about it, and then I thought maybe we could just take a little bit of a break, a stretch. Okay. Now, from that world picture I showed opening, this was the left-hand panel, the left-hand panel, which is the Garden of Eden and all in a kind of creation scene. You can see the birds whirling up in the air there to the left. This fountain with an owl right at the center. And I thought of that patient this week brought a dream with a beautiful big symmetrical tree with a hole in it out of which water poured. That's all I'll say because I don't usually go there, so that kind of talk. But anyhow, it comes up with the same, the wateriness, the fountain. And we'll see in the center panel the different fountains that create the water in the central panel. But you'll see as we see this and the center panel of the other as a whole and in detail, we will see how they're each rather independently compositions, have a bowl-like quality, play of water in them. Okay? So a thing that's conspicuously absent here is go off book here and just do the rest extemporaneously and just say, interject the material that I had way more time and I would have given in full. I don't need it. Hold that. Okay. Well, right, as we had it. Okay. Good. All right. Okay. Well, wait, maybe there was, what was the, you inquired whether there was a detail of this. Maybe this is, this I hadn't remembered how crystal clear that really was. So the wonderful swirl of birds. Yeah. I was sent a video a couple weeks ago that showed this, that showed all the movements of these huge flocks of birds, how they never run into one another, swirling around and all making like a split second, decision, in quotes, a decision together. Anyhow, one thing about this particular top that's noteworthy is the absolutely fantastic landscape items at the top. That's really what I was referring to when I said about Bosch's imagination, you know, crawled off, or as if things crawled off the manuscript page, like the Book of Hours of the Master of Cleve, Catherine of Cleve, and went just started growing on its own. Okay, but one thing you can see that there's a mixture of real and fantastic animals here. There's a unicorn, etc. Oh, I just noticed there's a bear here climbing up the tree. Forgot to mention that. Okay. This also gives you a nice sense of the way the paint is laid on in layers, and the way from some of the time of this. This is an older version, however. So when we get to the new clean version, it'll be quite a thing. Not an improvement, but clearer in its detail. The remarkable number of birds in the altarpiece always much appealed to me. Okay.
Is that a monkey on the elephant?
Oh, yes. Yeah. One thing I think, I think it's a bit futile, just interpretively, if one were to, and this is a kind of a thing that has pertinent to people having dreams and using symbol lexicons, is that if you go through a painting like this, not just Bosch, but a lot of it, and say, the monkey, oh, look up monkey, and then find out what that is. Then, oh, elephant, and then finds out. And then the two together and try to figure out how that it's a little like taking a scientific attitude, or where if you have a beautiful flamingo, that if you cut it up in all of its pieces and do a chemical analysis on all of them, that you'll better understand the flamingo. It's the flamingo that's at issue. Just like the dream is, you can say whatever you want. And you can interpret it with the symbol lexicon, but mostly just to let the image be alive. Okay. Very charming elephant, isn't it? With his. Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm the wrong button. Pardon me. Excuse me. There we go. Okay. I'm confused. Oh, wait. I am getting this mixed up with this machine. Next one. All right. This is a nice close-up, then, of the pair. Adam and Eve. It's kind of ambiguous, the picture. What do you think of the picture of Jesus? You can respond to the pictures as we go along, too, if there's a comment. Because on one hand, of course, it's Yahweh, God the Father, or whatever, but it's such a kind of Christ-like figure, so Christ is so commonly portrayed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, checking the pulse.
What is this done in relationship to the marriage?
It was painted in the, like the mid, like 15, I think it was 1500 to 1505 in there. Okay. This is out of place, right? This is an anticipation of our looking at the right-hand panel. It's just one detail of the hell panel that we will proceed. A few things in the details too, where that the heretical question will come up. Okay, so this is the whole central panel. And you can see the top with its fountains, its fantastic fountains, and these spheres, and the flowing waters. That's the composition is really, what, like I showed you, is follows Van Eyck a bit. And then there's this beautiful procession of of animals and figures going around. What I'm going to do is show you a couple of, we will have many details of the lower part of this, and I'll kind of work from the top down looking at some details. But the thing that if you just notice the tremendous play of these beautiful figures and very imaginative figures, where is there? I'll save the comments later. Let's look up a little closer. This is the top where you can really see just how fantastic these shapes really are. If any of you have ever read anything about fractal theory and how what's light, and you know, the same kind of structures on this level, on this level, on this level, on this level of of magnitude in the created world, it comes like there's something also. No wonder there's been things posited about Bosch that he used had ergot. It was a kind of hallucinogen that would come from eating rye sometimes in the Middle Ages. But that's to take the psychedelic out. That was, of course, sort of a 60s phenomenon. But there's really nothing in this central panel that would be suggestive of the dangers or evils or embarrassment or any kind of pejorative feeling about sexuality or the body, but rather it's a grand celebration of a sensual life. One remark that Harbison makes, the slide is a little dusty at the top, is that, and much is summed up by the remark, is that, of course, Bosch was around the court of the Burgundian court and the representatives in his town. Harbison mentions that seeking a courtly sexual paradise, we are faced as well with a multiplication of monsters and humiliations beyond our wildest dreams. You know? Because there's a one-sidedness to that. And we find that like I said before, the most beautiful sorts of beautiful, aesthetically beautiful things that the psyche dishes out in dreams, because that's just the beauty and the aesthetic dimension of things that my mentor, older colleague James Hillman has talked so much about when he's written and lectured about, is not a part of psychology at all, but it's really, really essential, like I said, of the Catholic vision of visio beatifica, of the mystic rose promised in Catholic Catholicism. But let's get a little closer to this pool. I think that's next. Oh, wait. I'm going to stop. Skip that. I'm sorry. Okay. It's like a yoga exercise of some sort. But to try to pin this down or explain it iconographically really is defying. You can talk about, for instance, all that waterness as being part of the tradition of different themes in art, like the pool of Venus or the Garden of Love theme that was associated with courtly love and such. But you know, Bosch uses traditional forms and the altar, you know, like the threefold triptych, altarpiece kind of thing, traditional forms, but he really likes to tell his own story and uses them in a real playful way. You know, not necessarily at all moral sermons. There's one art historian, my first Northern Renaissance professor at Iowa, said that Bosch was first and foremost a moralist and among the most medieval, looking backward, the most medieval of painter of his time. And I think that's completely an error, because I think that he was not necessarily a moralist, and that the way that he channels an awareness of the archetypal life of the collective unconscious or the psyche is extraordinarily forward-looking and modern, particularly just his freedom to play with different things. Now, Hieronymus Bosch was very much admired by people like Salvador Dali and the other surrealists, too, for his flamboyant imagination. Okay. And of course, not just because it's from the medieval, and just because it's in a sort of churchy form, that doesn't mean that Bosch has to be all about the things that Bosch believed in, or the moral judgments he made. But rather, first, it's a work of art, and maybe that's something different than those things. Mm-hmm. And also, too, like with the what the black person and what the attitude of the black person was in such and such a period. There's not a commentary on that. It's just dark persons and light persons. Wash leaves this open in a way. You can see here how this is a very good close-up, but we're little brush strokes and stuff. He works in kind of a up close, it almost starts to look, what would you say, almost a tiny bit expressionistic up close, or like you'd see in a much later kind of painting. Okay. Yeah. No. Now, this is really such a wonderful thing. I love this particular detail. Just as far as the feeling of the loveliness of it and a real-world sense of that was, I was lucky enough to go up north of Galveston, Texas, to one of the great migratory beaches of waterbirds in the whole continent. It's a famous place to go birdwatching. And I was there just after dawn, and the first thing I saw was a little flock of roseate spoonbills, these beautiful pink birds, and white ibises, and I think it was within about half an hour as the sun came up, four different species of herons, and all these beautiful birds. And it was just such a, like the romantic poets to say, such sort of gazing upon nature's naked loveliness. Just so. It didn't have to mean anything. There was no moral judgment to be made. It was not teaching. It was just like that aesthetic I talked about. But to make a comment on this in terms of the anima, of course, this painting, I'm sorry, what'd you say?
I'm just saying they're like holding out hands.
Yeah. It's kind of beholding.
Yeah.
Like, ah, here we are. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But in an anima comment, you know, the anima is always kind of plays the intermediary between things. She's kind of an individuating thing, but Jung talks about the anima as having so much to do with, and the feminine gender, with holism, with inclusive, and a ligament between opposites. Here's, like, if you think of the feet disappearing down into the water, you know, the void, the boundless, our ultimate origin, and yet on top having these birds, you know, aerial, upper-worldly, it's kind of like earth and heaven and the anima kind of being a personification of the above and the below. Okay. Another way to compare it or think about it in another image would be this image of a figure that's in alchemy called just the old expression Mesulina, her name is, of the mermaid, who has also has wings. I recently heard of a dream where a male version of this had wings and a fish's tail in a dream. Somebody had birds tied to his wrists so he could fly through the air, but he also had a fish's tail. It was a more extraordinary kind of mythical images I've seen in a while from out of a contemporary person. Another like unto it is this a little bit. This is an alchemical, because we focused there on the anima and the women figures, the female figures, but all the revelers around too, and the nudity of it and the naturalness of it. This is the masculine and feminine, the rex and rebus, the anima, the animus, whatever language you prefer to use, unifying and going in immersing in the alchemical bath or a renewing phase in the alchemical process. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Now, these are so lovely. This is from, of course, all of these are from that central pattern. And here you can just see there's so much in Bosch that has a feeling of wonderful embeddedness in nature. Okay. Okay. And as far as a fantasy, of course, but it is worth pointing out that this is like a European goldfinch, a European robin, that's a green kingfisher, the one with all the feathers on top is a hoopoe. You can see them in Italy and all the way across southern the Mediterranean all the way to Turkey. So those are real birds, but then in this fantastic circumstance, you know. He plays lots of games. Oh, and the mallard duck, too, that's familiar to us all. With his green head and those great curly tail feathers. Okay. This is one of my favorite parts of the whole altar. I have that whole chapter in my book called, with an unusual title, Syzygy Tango. It takes two to tango. A picaresque of dreams, just a flow of dreams. And syzygy is an old word for just the masculine and feminine pair. It means yoked together. Art historians use that. Jung used that. Anytime they talk about a sacred marriage or the dynamism of anima and anima, whatever, in fairy tales, Mr. and Mrs. God, Sophia and Christ, Jesus and Magdalene, you know, those are all the exemplary couple. I remember Arlene and I were watching TV once when Tom Cruise and what was the girlfriend? Nicole Kidman were at their peak right after Eyes Wide Shut. And they appeared for the press, like standing, each beautifully clad, put together, holding each other like by the at fingertip length, as all these flash cameras went off. And I thought, it's like that's our response to Greek heroic mythology, or like the divine pair, the exemplary pair. And when humans try to do that or be that, they generally go poof after a while. But anyhow, and it's such a beautiful thing, mixture of the organic with plant forms, and then a kind of a membrane, almost like a placenta kind of feeling. There's an old story in Greek, in Egyptian mythology, about how Isis and Osiris clung to one another incestuously within their mother's womb. And then, as only mythology can do it, their mother was Isis. So don't expect rationality when you're in this territory. Just stay with the mystery of the image. This might have been the picture that I used for the cover of a book, but they let me make a collage instead. And incidentally, if you did get one or look at that, this picture appears right here. I did steal it to put in my own little collage for the front cover. All right. So, again, here, this is like, there's no, it's hard. You can see why the artist I mentioned, or art historian, Wilhelm Freyinger, could be so persuaded that this was an altarpiece or that this thing was commissioned by the sects that were part of the milieus in the centuries leading up to Bosch, where it was displaced people who were given to the kind of, if you were to think of David Koresh and that whole big thing about his the cult phenomenon where somebody is millennialist, the time is at hand, they're special elect persons, and of course because they're special elect, then their morality can be different from other people, and they have liberty to do this and that. In fact, it's their right, it's almost promiscuity on principle among some of them, always expecting the end time to be coming. And like I said, they were the ones who were part of that 1,000 years that was supposed to be on earth a kind of paradise before the last judgment. And so this, you can see why this would be easily, for an art historian to easily interpret this in those sorts of terms. Let's look at another. Okay. Now, this is a, this is to, if you remember that first scene we saw with all the water of the whole altarpiece, this speaks of that, but is also pertinent to the kind of imagery that we see here and that we'll see in the next pictures. And again, comes from Harbison, who's the latest and the best writer on Bosch. I'm so at ease to have found out that there's all these new understandings of him. Let me just read this before we go to the next picture. The central pattern alludes to a variety of favorite courtly images. The Garden of Love, the Pool of Venus, the Power of Women, the Fountain of Youth. From Netherlands folklore and proverbs, we learn that the various fruits which Bosch shows his figures nibbling were indeed understood as metaphors for sexual organs. A great number of popular 15th and 16th century erotic badges, I guess just I'd like to see them, have recently been unearthed in the Netherlands. This is very recent research. They represent such things as a vulva and a penis on a ladder, a vulva on a mussel shell. I mean, that's the most ancient equation, because Aphrodite is the shell. Yeah. Okay. Figures copulating on a knife or displaying their rear ends on and so on. explicit sexual imagery was definitely widespread in Bosch's day. Okay. So this is very frank. And that it was made to serve in an Orthodox Catholic Christian context is really almost inconceivable. That was a major part of what Franger's thing. But again, this is Bosch using those traditional forms and daringly and with a mind of modernity about him, looking forward in time, not back, although he remembered and was fascinated with all the many antiquarian interests, that it was his own use of traditional forms to tell his own story. Okay. Very fantastic shapes. This here, it even has a little bit of some strange, like a strawberry, but the way it's on the back, it almost makes one think of a sort of something having to do with a nervous system, spine and brain or something. Total revelry. It's, you know, and what was said before about the whole idea of like evolving at just on a courtly level, this fantastic, erotic in the broadest sense, focus, inevitable, that plunges one into a place, the movies are filled with it, where then there's always the shadow side of it comes too, where there's the decay, the falling apart, the abuse, the power to things that come into it, etc. This is a lovely little detail. It makes me think of that famous painting by Manet, Luncheon on the Grass. Very close-up, intimate thing with meeting of eyes.
Astonishing
foliage. Yes.
Yes, isn't it beautifully rich? Okay, yeah. So this is the hell panel. There's one thing. This is one vignette that I want. It's in my book. It comes from an earlier time. The years leading up to Bosch, like the several centuries leading up to Bosch, that was also a time where the cult of the virgin was springing up, where the feminine really did want back in to have her share of devotion, and largely by popular demand. But I did want to give you this one vignette that's so interesting to the idea of heresy, the body, natural forces, natural excitations, and what that means to possible alternate or extravagant religious attitudes. And this is just one little vignette that I just have to share because it's so interesting. Okay. One poignant anecdote, an experience of natural symbolism, often cited by historians, conveys something of the shadow side, or the sexual shadow of Christianity, the heretical and the heretical imagination. And this is from about the year 1000 in a little village in France, where a gentleman named Lutherd came to be regarded as a veritable satanic emissary. Think of this vignette with regards to the whole points of the various themes I've talked about tonight. Okay, his stubborn insanity began when he was once, this is a simple man, he was once laboring alone in a field and had just about finished a piece of work when, wearied by his exertions, he fell asleep, and it seemed to him that a great swarm of bees entered his body through his privates. These same bees made their way out through his mouth with a loud noise, tormenting him by their stings. And after he had been vexed in this fashion for some time, they seemed to speak to him, bidding him to do things impossible for men. Luther dismisses his wife, vandalizes an image of the Savior in a nearby church, begins preaching, but, following a theological dispute with the local bishop, ends up throwing himself to his death in a well. Luther is completely overwhelmed by an archetypal experience here, suddenly rendering him larger than life and no less inspired than psychically inflated. I would have given you, with a little more time, of one of these wandering spirituals who had a statue of the Virgin taken out in the city square and had this whole rap about he was the elect one and married himself to the Virgin in the city square, and everybody, and he actually got a lot of money from the crowd. And there's other things of this sort, like people who would turn away from all the establishment of the church, who held so many wealthy holdings and excluded them so completely, uprooted people along the whole Rhineland. In these centuries, there were all manner of people anticipating the apocalypse, claiming some kind of ultimate elect wisdom, in many ways out of just a fabulously desperate sense of inferiority. And having even networks across Europe where some of them, like the Brethren of the Free Spirit and other things like that, had just kind of their networks of their own, all with an erratic tinge to their relationship and quite outside of the church's influence. Okay. Forgive me one second. Forgive me one second. Here is a thing that Franger found provocative and picks up on this strand. It's difficult to see here, but there's a group of people here with different kinds of hoods and horns, engaged in a kind of a black mass or kind of a crazy alternative goings on here, and those are some of the things that Franger took from this painting to posit his theory. It's interesting that the art historian I've mentioned, besides talking about obvious things like the way the ears can be tortured in contrast to hearing of beautiful music, they can also be tortured, or that the senses can lead to extremely trying emotions, etc. Those kinds of imagery are replete through here, and also the whole the shadow side of the body's reality, like people playing horns or trumpeting out of their rears, things like that. So it's kind of a world flipped upside down, a world gone crazy, in the tradition of the trickster, the mummer plays, the old Saturnalia, the day when they would have the fool would be declared pope. A complete kind of disruption or day of celebrating, like carnival, a disruption and a reversal of all conscious values. And so that dynamism is in all of us. Jung talks about the more that some of the ego becomes unconsciously in the grip of the unconscious, the more there tends to be a reversal of all conscious norms. And so it's a state of moral vacuum, moral suspension, which has lots of different possibilities, dark or light. Okay. There's also torturing of heretics here going on, and rioting people, because there were various peasant upheavals, even in the Burgundian court, which were summarily put down, and a great element of class struggle there. Okay. He doesn't look so much rent as he does, it's just an odd shape, but it certainly looks like a battlefield horror. Okay. Here's another thing too, just like a mock crucifixion, like the of the person like spread out on a rack, or in our era, it's like Khmer Rouge putting people on racks to electrocute them, or that sort of thing. But all just the conflicted and torturous part of the sensual world, which is inescapable. Explorations in deep unconscious states and in near-death experiences also have their downside, and psychedelic experience brings out very starkly contrasting sides of the psyche. The demonic energies, in quotes, and celestial, you know, and beautiful, incredible tension with one another. Okay. The special thing on gambling and the hurdy-gurdy, idle amusements. Let's see. Excuse me, I get my buttons mixed up because it takes a particular turn. Okay. Yeah. Now, this is really quite fantastic. Oh, there was one thing early. Forgive me, just pardon this clumsiness. Where is that? I wanted to include the one thing back here. Down here. Yeah, this is it. As far as the world turns upside down, here is a hare in a big coat, and he's got a human being on his lance stake. So the hare has become the hunter, and the human the hunted. Okay. Okay, pardon me, I'll catch up. I didn't mean to joggle your eyes with all this switching. Okay, next. This is a typical thing, too. This is very common. Here's somebody playing a musical instrument with their anus. You know, it's like, it makes me think of the boys when they're 11 or 12, 13, and they're kind of in that swamp, you know, like spit and...
Well, it's kind of funny because I had a French Canadian friend who lived in Europe most of her life, uh-huh. and said you never hear anyone fart in Europe.
Uh-huh.
And she went back from here and decided, well, she was going to let loose a little bit.
Right.
Because it's everybody squeezes it off, she said, and you never hear it there. So this would be, I don't know what it was like in the 15th century in Europe.
Sure, the same, right. But, you know, sexuality has always had tremendous buffoonery and humor about it also. That part of it's essential, burlesque, you know. Okay. Okay, pardon me. That is where I conclude with the actual Bosch pictures. And we can go back to them or have a discussion here a bit. But I thought just in respect for maybe one, how this has influenced me in my artistic side, that would be worth including would be this is one etching that I did, engraving that I did as an art student at the University of Iowa, and that big sphere thing came right out of the hell panel, you know, the kind of egg shape. Is it a torn up guy or is it kind of an egg shape with a mimic in the background? It's 16 by 24 inches, I think. And this other one, too, captures a kind of Bosch feeling, also from the hell panel. That's a line etching I did. in the book of Ezekiel, they talk about him being in such psychic pain and anguish that he can't die, but he is in torment, but he can't die. And so I called it the fear of Ezekiel. I was really interested in the book of Ezekiel for quite a while. And so here you can see that he's coming unraveled. In fact, the guy tries to throw himself on his own sword to kill himself and can't succeed. So that captures torment pretty well. Like, let's, you know, dems that die is the lucky ones, the old pirate line. So you can see he's holding here a sword stuck through him. And then this is just kind of a boogie monster and with fangs. So a disturbing image. And then I wanted to finally conclude, go back to a little bit more of the paradigm, maybe the central panel feeling, with a collage I did, I think about 17 or 18 years ago, on the theme of, this one's first, I'll get to that, the theme of the rape of Persephone. This is a detail from one of my collages also, with the elephant, you can make out the elephant around it, with a little black child with golden wings sitting on it. And I tried to capture that whole idea of kind of animistic, the oneness of all the animals. It's like a Hindu theme, you see it in Indian art, of the lion that's filled with all of the planets and stars and all animals and things like that. Sometimes it's an elephant or a lion. But that's definitely still that Bosch feeling, or the little bit of that kind of sense of everything touching each other in a kind of holistic, maybe even ecological sense. Okay. All right. But this is it's a real large collage about, like I said, from 17 or 18 years ago. And in the, it's the Rape of Persephone has Persephone in it. It has Hecate, the underworldly witch, in it. It has, Pan in it, who I portrayed that way. It has Helios in it. I just used the sun. It has Hades in it, which is a skull. And it has Persephone after she's been tumbled into the underworld, who I portray here. Okay? Okay. And take a closer look. You know, this is a picture of it up close.
Now, are these all in the order that you did them? These last three or four?
Oh, yeah. Those other ones were much earlier.
Right.
Yeah. And stuff. So this has a little bit of that same fantastic quality that I've always carried over from Bosch and Bruegel and the artists of that milieu. Now, there's one image here, too, that gets maybe off into the hell panel and makes the immediate impression of thinking, my God, what a hideous sexist picture to include. But there's a psychological reason for that. I don't know if any of you ever saw the movie with Michael Douglas and where she and the scary woman who had killed the rabbit.
Yeah.
What was the name of it?
Fatal Attraction.
That one. That whole thing, or like it was there in Leaving Las Vegas with Elizabeth Shue. The whole thing about, you know, you can do whatever you want with me. You know, you can, you know, sexually. You know, you can have your way with me. And for most guys, a lot of men, male eros, that's like, cool, wow, this is like, you know, sitting on a great opportunity here. But psychologically, that kind of anima image is kind of the ultimate in, there's a, however bound and passive and at put out there, it's the ultimate exercise in jailbait too, but in a psychological sense, about being drawn from all of the, maybe the idyllic fantasy of courtly, fancy, Playboy Mansion sex to its exact opposite. And that's how overwhelmed with one's instinct one can get with too much libertarianism. That's they find that in the heretic thing that pops up too, is the ascetic and the libertine. There's the ascetics we know from the church history, monks are familiar, but then the libertine response to that or shadow side of that is, and one of the real downsides that these some of these heretic groups claim was that prerogative for ultimate liberty. And of course, that goes back to the old adage, total freedom is total demise and destruction. So, I'll leave it here with a little bit of collage. Having given you quite a presentation tonight, I hope we can still talk about it for a few minutes. This is a figure I stole from the wedding of Giovanni and Arnolfini of Van Eyck, except I gave him more of like an alchemical limbic up-down, upside-down, so it looks like a strange beetle, or and out-walking a beetle. So, but just kind of a very Bosch-like, playful... like a weevil, that's what I was thinking of, like a weevil with a long nose, out walking his other beetle with a golden chain. So that, if anything I ever did, was had influenced by Bosch and a northern painter from whom I stole an image, this is it. So with that, I'll conclude. Oh, but I'll wait a minute. That's too ugly to have it just white. And we can go back and look at some pictures if you would like, but otherwise, why don't we have a time just to have a few comments and some discussion.
Can we go back to you? Well, I have kind of a long question.
Okay.
Which is, it seems to me this is an unusual moment to have somebody who's taken a look at, you know, a real edgy, powerful, psychological artist, mm-hmm. and then... you know, given us the gift of seeing your own material. And so I find what I'm thinking about is wondering how you might be able to talk about what happens in your own art process as some of these come to the fore and how you complete them. That's one question. Mm-hmm. And the other one is I would enjoy a little more of you delving down into some of the aspects that are in here, because most artists, we don't have the gift to talk, let alone some of the psychological perspective to you to talk about the art process and how that's a vehicle for your own individuation.
That is a very, very large question. I'm not going to go into discussing my personal part of it for just reasons of discretion, but it was in my attempt artistically to just deal with that myth that I show really fundamental, like the whole thing of like that the you know the story first of the taking Persephone into the underworld. You know, that's such an old pattern in our mythology. You know, it's like the Beauty and the Beast is that, goes back to Amor and Psyche, goes back to that myth, and as the basis of one of the great mystery religions of the world, Eleusis, and it goes back from there, even to Sumer, the descent of the goddess, of Pereira, it's like the deep roots of that. This was also an attempt to capture and come to terms with my own erotic fantasy.
Sure.
And kind of bring it, like, and, you know, because I obviously, the book could never have come without battling with all of that. It's inconceivable. And so this is a way of sort of dealing with that and coming to understand that in a visual way. Sort of like what's used, there's an old German expression, "Can I catch the devil, paint his picture on the wall." It's like that. So much of artwork is like it was definitely a whole process of a personal mythologizing over a few years. And this is, yeah, the most overt, erotic kind of picture that I've probably ever seen. I think I'm just going to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But as far as the individuation part of it, I think at some point one of the art historians, the Olden Cutler, talks about Bosch as a creator, about his inventing of fantasy, kind of. And there's just no sense there of the way in which psyche has this autonomous life and just presents images that just come unbidden. You know, Jung struggled with that. What is it in me that makes me think about these things? Because he did not will that this come in. The Red Book's a testament to what a struggle that. It talks about it taking a demonic effort. So I think that the particular, just stays, he kind of stays within a way of the moralizing box. Okay. Shall we go with another? Or is there a picture? Should I go back to either any of the large pictures, or should we turn the lights and have a general discussion? Or what would you like to do? We have.
I'm not sure what this is related to. Possibly nothing.
Uh-huh.
But you made a statement that keeps sort of going around in my head. I think it was the shadow side of sexuality within Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And that. I wonder if you could elaborate on that a little bit, because sexuality within Christianity, if the shadow side is the...
And that is the end of the recording. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society Seattle and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.